Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It's Friday, so it's time for Week in Review. In Studio 3 here is Arlene Isaacson, president of Isaacson Political Consulting and co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. Welcome back, Arlene.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Also with us is Joe Battenfeld, a political columnist at the Boston Herald and host of Battenfeld on Boston Herald Radio. Welcome back, Joe.
Thanks for having me.
And you're with us, so call. Pull up a chair at the kitchen table. What did you think of what you heard from Ernest Moniz, the latest on Iran? What about the president's war powers and where we stand on impeachment? Call us. What do you make of it all? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Let me just start with reactions to what we just heard from Ernest Moniz, former Secretary of Energy. Obviously, a very specific perspective on Iran and the nuclear deal. Joe?
Well, obviously, he's the expert on this, but I thought it was interesting that he did not say that the killing of Soleimani was not necessarily would not work, that he agreed that it's possible that it could force Iran to the table and, you know, cause a de-escalation of the conflict.
So, Arlene, that means that Radio Boston has had two former Obama administration officials on this week acknowledging that it's possible that the president's approach here with the drone strike on Soleimani could work. Do you think that that's an idea that's getting broad attention or traction with the American people, and should it?
I think that I have a lot of respect for Ernest Moniz and the work that he's done in the diplomatic arena. So his opinion carries with me great, great weight. And any time you can achieve something diplomatically, I'm inclined to think that it's a better idea than not. The past week, I've learned that two previous presidents, both Obama and Bush, had to confront this very question about Soleimani and whether they should take
him out. Whether they should do it.
And that in each case, they did a cost-benefit analysis and decided that killing him would be as bad, if not worse, than letting him live. And so the question is, does that same calculus apply now?
And do you think it does?
I have no idea.
So, and isn't that where we are to some extent as an American
people? Well, but the thing is, yes, we don't know. But the problem that we face is this. There's a public policy question involved, of course. But then there's a question of who it is that you believe. And when you're dealing with a president who has a very bad track record of lying, it makes it a lot harder to trust his views and his facts as the things that he says are facts.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Join our panelists. Be part of this conversation. We're interested in what you think. Joe, what's your response to what Arlene just said?
Yeah, I think in general, the American people want to support a president at times like this, but I think those times may be gone because of what happened in Iraq and what happened in Afghanistan, that people are just kind of fed up with that and, you know, the prolonged conflicts there. And so they may not. The country is so polarized right now that it's going to come down. It's this question itself is polarizing, whether the killing of Soleimani was appropriate or not. So I think the country is split on that, as well as it is on a number of things.
Well, you know, we went through something similar when W. Bush was president, and he used WMDs, you know, the weapons of mass destruction, and used that as the justification for attacking Iraq. And at that time, there was a bipartisan support. Many of the Democrats now regret supporting him.
But they did.
But they were willing to do it. And there's reason to not feel the same way with this particular president, given his track record.
So I want to ask you, you know, we're here in Boston. The three of us are not big, you know, Washington, D.C. policy experts, but we're American citizens. We're voters. And on Wednesday, we all heard the president come to the podium and talk after this retaliation Tuesday night. And he said two things. The tit for tat seems to be done, and we are hitting Iran with new sanctions. Joe, what was your reaction to the president's speech?
I think, like most people, kind of breathe a sigh of relief that things weren't getting out of control, because I think there was a real fear that, you know, with what happened with Iran striking back, that it would escalate with Trump then doing something. The fact that Trump did not strike back, I think, was heartening to a lot of people who, like I said, do not want a war with Iran. It's clear the American people do not want that. I don't think the Iranian government wants it. I don't think, actually, the U.S. government wants that either.
Arlene, what did he need to do, and did he do it?
Well, you know, in some ways, I think that Trump was lucky. Lucky that when the Iranians hit the base, that they didn't kill any Americans.
Thank God. Why do you say that?
Well, because I think we'd be looking at a very different calculation if they had. And they destroyed property at our air base. And they didn't kill any Americans.
Do you think that was by design?
I don't know. But I do know that the question, to me, the threshold question is, are we safer now that they've actually taken out Soleimani? And if you look at some of the results of this killing, we've got the U.S. that's being thrown out of Iraq, which is going to help ISIS. We've got Iran restarting its nuclear weapons program. We've got Iranian citizens who were protesting their government previously, and now they're supporting it. And you've got Iran saying that they're going to vow for future revenge. We don't know what kind. That doesn't make me feel safer.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation, which Eric from Woburn is going to do. Eric, what's on your mind?
Hi, yes. So I just think of one of the consequences of killing Soleimani was that he was known for fighting ISIS. And now that he's gone, it seems like ISIS now has a place to kind of grow because there really is no plan for the Middle East. At least to me, it seems like that. And that's pretty much all I got. Thank you.
So, Eric, thanks for that call. And that gets to Arlene's point, Joe, about are we safer now or not with this step? It does seem that activities against ISIS have been suspended and our relationship, our military relationship with Iraq is at least on the rocks right now. So how do you think about that?
It's too soon to tell, really. I think there is an argument to be made that the killing of Soleimani will eventually overall make us safer because the fact that before this attack happened, what happened is Iran organized these protests and you know, at the U.S. embassy. And, you know, which was a very dangerous situation. And things were escalating out of control there. So I think, you know, the fact that things haven't escalated beyond, you know, Iraq just doing that, whether it was purposeful or not, I'm not sure. But I don't really trust Iran was trying not to do damage. You know, the fact that they shot down an airliner, too, indicates their general ineptness, I think.
All right. So this is one of those weeks where we have unlimited topics to cover, but we do not have unlimited time. So we're going to turn our talk to impeachment now. Listeners, call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or tweet us at Radio Boston. Is it time to go through the impeachment trial in the Senate? And what do you expect from that trial? So Speaker Nancy Pelosi said yesterday Here's what she said yesterday about when she might send the articles over to the Senate.
I'll send them over when I'm ready. And that will probably be soon. We want to see what they're willing to do and the manner in which they will do it. But we will not let them say, oh, this is just like Clinton, fair is fair. It's not.
So apparently she's ready because today she announced that next week they're going over. Is it time?
Well, it looks like she's backing down to me. I mean, she was hoping that there would be this pressure campaign on the Trump administration that somehow withholding the articles of impeachment would actually help Democrats' cause. I don't see how it's helped Democrats' cause at all. The American people are sort of tuning out of impeachment already. Because of it.
Arlene, do you agree with that?
No, actually, I don't. I think that there has been a collateral benefit to her delaying it. I think it's allowed it exposes the Senate for the sham trial that it will be, that Mitch McConnell is not even pretending that there'll be any degree of impartiality. And very importantly, it's allowed more time for more information to come forward, the possibility of more information, the possibility of more witnesses like John Bolton saying, oh, yeah, if I'm subpoenaed, I would come and testify.
Do either of you think there's anybody who felt one way about impeachment, but as a result of this delay, feels differently about it now on either side?
Maybe the fact that they're sick of it now more than they were before, just because of all this gamesmanship going on. And, you know, people are kind of wondering why there's been this delay when they had, you know, the House impeachment vote. And if things were so urgent that they had to impeach him, then why are we waiting 2 weeks?
I don't blame someone. If we reduced it to a local level issue and if the police thought that they could get more information before going to trial, they would. It'd be crazy not to. And I think she was smart to try.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Melissa from Watertown, jump on in here.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I think that my sentiments echo your guest when she made the point that Donald Trump does lie, and that puts us in all kinds of trouble. We just can't trust what he's doing and what he's saying and what his motivations are. I also think that even though everybody can agree that Soleimani was a bad guy, killing him only and with that huge display of distressed citizens is only going to create more terrorists in the future. And I think that we would have been much better to continue down a road of diplomacy, because ultimately I think that
Melissa, I've got a lot of callers, so we got a couple ideas there from you. Thank you. I want to put one more caller on the line. We've got Michael from Everett. Michael, jump in.
Hey, I just want to say that at this point, you know, if the Senate's not going to give a fair trial, they're not going to give a fair trial. Fine. Give it to them. Have them not do a fair trial. There's more information coming out all the time. Do another impeachment. And the other thing I just want to point out, if anyone hasn't seen the movie, go watch the movie Wag the Dog and then think about what's going on with
De Niro and Pacino. Stuff. All right. So let me just ask you, Joe, what's your reaction to the rinse and repeat argument?
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure if that's going to work or not, really, the rinse and repeat, because, you know, people are, like I said, people are kind of getting fed up with the whole impeachment saga, I think, and want Washington to move on.
Okay, so one more question on this, then we will move on. Arlene, what is fair? So we're hearing a lot about Mitch McConnell saying fair is fair. This is the same as Clinton. That's fair. Nancy Pelosi saying I'm not going to let them get away with fair is fair. There's a lot of back and forth about witnesses. For the average person, what would a fair impeachment trial look like?
It's a very interesting question. I found it fascinating what Nancy Gertner said the other day about how she described the phenomena of the House is like a grand jury. They're the ones that make the accusation. The Senate is then trying the accusation. And the facts matter. And the fact that the Senate would not allow witnesses or even evidence to come in is kind of gobsmacking to any person who knows about the trial system in a traditional context. So I think it sort of highlights the fact that there's going to be a lot of theater involved in this, a lot more theater than reality, in fact.
Okay, I'm getting ready to go to a break. But before I do, let's give a listener the last word on this. We've got Kathy from Cape Cod. Kathy, go ahead.
Hi, I actually just want to make a point about Nancy Pelosi and that the delay in putting the impeachment forward. And she made it very clear what her delay was about. She wanted to ensure that it would be a fair practice. And she basically said to the Senate, please show me what your plans are for an impeachment trial, and I'd be happy to hand this over. She said it a number of times. I don't know why it acts like it's such a mystery for everyone, like she's somehow holding on to this golden egg. She's not. She wants to make sure there's a fair Senate hearing.
Kathy, I love the golden egg imagery. We're going to go to a break on that image. It can hang out there for everyone. Arlene Isaacson, president of Isaacson Political Consulting. Stick around. Joe Battenfeld, political columnist at Boston Herald and host of Battenfeld on Boston Herald Radio. Stick around. Listeners, stick around. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston's Week in Review. Welcome back to Radio Boston's Week in Review. I'm Tiziana Deering. Before the break, we did Iran and impeachment, but we are shifting gears. It is time for State of the City. Still here in Studio 3 to help me talk about it is Arlene Isaacson, political consultant and co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus, and Joe Battenfeld, a political columnist at the Boston Herald. He's host of Battenfeld on Boston Herald Radio. And you, so call us. Did you listen to the State of the City address this week? The mayor had three big priorities: transportation, education, housing. What's important to you and what do you want to see from the mayor in 2020? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So, Arlene, those three big priorities, what do you want to do first?
Well, housing and transportation. Well, they're all critical.
Housing
important.
It is. You win.
All right.
Let's start with housing. What do you think?
Middle class is being just locked out of the middle and lower class and working class folks are being locked out of the city. And so I appreciate the fact that he's going to focus more on that. Unfortunately, like every other issue that he mentioned, almost every single thing depends on the state, whether it's state lawmakers or the governor, to get it done right and effectively. And so we're beholden to the legislature and the governor to step up.
So, Joe, you nodded and every head in the control room nodded on everything belonging. It depends on the state. Say some more about
that.
Well,
I find it interesting that Marty Walsh was a former legislator, and he's the one who's now sort of passing the buck to the legislature, saying you have to do this.
You think he's passing the buck?
I do think he's several times he mentioned it, not just on housing, on transportation as well. He was urging the state take action on that too. And in fact, he could do more to pressure the legislature than he's doing now. And I think it's the legislature has traditionally taken a not very fond look toward cities that try to do home rule petitions. They generally look down on those.
So let's anchor for our listeners who didn't hear the address on Tuesday night what Marty Walsh said about housing.
Rents and home prices are stabilizing, but they're still too high for too many people. There's much more work to be done. So tonight, I'm announcing an unprecedented investment, $500 million over 5 years to create thousands of homes all across our city, affordable to a range of incomes from our most vulnerable to the middle class.
Now, Governor Charlie Baker was sitting right in the front row there. It's not like he wasn't getting the message from Marty Walsh. But Arlene, what he just said is stuff that's pretty much in the city's purview to do. So are you questioning the mayor's ability to do what he just said there?
Yeah, there's an important caveat, which is that the city can only raise a certain amount of money because of Prop 2.5, the constraint on property tax increases. Other than that, they are dependent in large part on local aid from the state. And so unless the legislature is willing to give it and the governor willing to sign it and spend it, the city can only do so much.
Now, he also had revenue ideas, though, selling the Lafayette garage and the 2% transfer tax on real estate sales over $2 million. You have this look on your face like, ew,
The Lafayette garage was really not meant for that. It could be used for other things, you know, as just going into the general fund as opposed to this. I think he kind of stole that and put it in there to make it look like he was adding more money to the table.
So, one of the things that he talked about in housing was this idea that the city would provide city-funded vouchers for people to get housing. My first reaction to that was, oh, right, the city doesn't fund those now. But my second reaction was, will that grow the number of people who receive vouchers, or will that create almost a substitution value where other sources of funding, like state-level funding, might eventually dry up? Can the city really add over and above? Arlene?
It's an interesting question. There's always been a program called Section 8, but it was very unpopular in certain neighborhoods and certainly by people who owned homes that rented out some of that space to apartment dwellers. I think one of the issues that the state has to grapple with and allow is some local option for rent control, because that'll affect all the cities and towns that choose to go for it again.
Yeah, Marty Walsh didn't bring up rent control on Tuesday night, but he was on our show recently and he did address it.
We're looking at everything right now in the city. We're looking at what does rent control mean? I think a lot of people are afraid of rent control because of the name rent control. There's different forms of rent control now in the country. We're at a drastic point in time to think about how do we allow people the opportunity to stay in the city of Boston, live in the city of Boston.
What's your reaction to that, Jeff?
I think he's getting pressure by other city councilors on this issue, and he's feeling the pressure. The fact that he's even open to rent control says that, because in the past this has been anathema to a lot of politicians, a rent control argument. And I think the fact that he wants to be bold, he said bold about 12 times in that speech. Just because you say bold doesn't mean you are bold. If he really wanted to be bold, he would have embraced some form of rent control.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Should the mayor have embraced rent control in the state of the city on Tuesday night? Do you think his proposals for housing, education, and transportation were bold? Is he moving the ball forward in your mind? Call us and share your thoughts. Joe, I'm going to come back to you because Arlene got first pick and she picked housing. So what do you pick?
Transportation, was the biggest issue on most people's minds.
And what do you want to talk about from that, from what you heard Tuesday night?
Well, again, he's relying a bit on the state to do more. In fact, he was urging the state to do more and be bold like the city was being bold. Which I think is a good thing. I believe Speaker DeLeo was at the speech. I'm not sure, but I saw him there. I think that seemed to be aimed at Speaker DeLeo, which the city, which many people believe the state is not acting fast enough on transportation measures.
Do you think the state is acting fast enough?
I do. I do. I think what fast enough means is maybe a gas tax. DeLeo is going slow on that, and a lot of people would like him to move quicker on that.
Arlene, how reliant is the city of Boston on action by the state legislature or the governor in order to solve its really hyper-intense transportation woes inside the city of Boston.
It's huge because the vast majority of the traffic is coming from outside the city, from people who don't live here. And the city, even though it's become a wealthier city than ever before, simply won't have the finances to deal with that. And so much of it is about public transportation, which is an MBTA state-run entity.
So this was a moment that stood out for me that night on transportation.
And I'm calling once again for the city of Boston to have a seat on the MBTA board. Our city and our residents are the largest taxpayers into the MBTA. This is Boston, and we've never been big fans of taxation without representation. You deserve a voice.
That drew, as you can hear, a big response from the crowd, Joe. And, you know, it was interesting because, as I said before, Governor Baker was right there. Mm-hmm. And Mayor Walsh and Governor Baker have long had a strong relationship. But that was a throwdown. So are we seeing a shift over because of transportation in that relationship? And will that actually be more effective over time in getting things solved? Or does that tension undermine what Mayor Walsh is trying to do?
I don't think it undermines it. I think what Walsh is trying to do is emphasize, he's mentioned this before about wanting the state to have a seat on the MBTA board. So that wasn't new. The fact that he did it right there in his speech and, had the little joke with it, I think it got people's attention on it. But again, if he really wanted to be bold, he could have endorsed, say, free bus rides. By the MBTA, so an idea that's being pushed by some city councilors, but he didn't.
And I believe Lowell has
far.
Been experimenting with it on at least one bus line for the last 2 years. Are we pushing far enough in the city, Arlene? Joe says, hey, if you're really serious, maybe make the buses free. Are there other things we should be pushing for that we're not?
Unfortunately, we're so overly dependent on the state to solve this problem for us and for the region that really no mayor can do anything other than beg. State.
And actually, I want to correct. I said Lowell and I meant to say Lawrence. It's there that they've got a bus line that's been almost 2 years in a pilot program providing that bus transportation.
And I think
free.
It's worked, too.
Well, the early returns seem to have been good. And, various levels of free MBTA are something we've heard from different city council members. We've talked about it here on the show before. I want to move to hubbubs in just a second, but one word from each of you on education. The mayor, extra $100 million in funding. What's the big priority in education, Arlene, in your mind for the next couple of years?
I think he's doing the right thing. I'm glad he's putting more money in. And recent Globe articles show that one of the things that has to be dealt with are the deplorable conditions of the bathrooms, because when a kid is sitting in a classroom and unwilling, unable, and scared to go to the bathroom because it's disgusting or rodent-filled or broken, how do they learn in an environment like that?
It's interesting. One of our commentators Tuesday night, the analyst, was Jennifer Nasur, who had just run for Boston City Council, and that was a theme she came back to two or three times in her comments. That specifically, I think that is something that's got parents in the city feeling quite strongly. How about you, Jim?
I mean, I've listened to several dozen of these State of the City speeches in my lifetime, and they always talk about education. The mayor always mentions education, says what a big priority it's going to be. I'm going to fund extra things or put extra funding in it, which Walsh did. But, what we want to see are results. And like Arlene mentioned, doing things like cleaning up bathrooms and things like that, and making it more livable for students to learn it.
All right. So we'll be watching for that. But before we run out of time, let's turn to our hubbubs. We all love them. And we could use a little happy or interesting or trivia even at the end of this week. These are the brief stories or events that caught our attention. Arlene, why don't you go first?
Okay. On a totally unrelated topic for hubbub this week, I have an Arizona Republican lawmaker who has proposed legislation that includes a provision prohibiting the discussion of homosexuality in public schools.
Well, that is schools.
Yes, in schools. including, she would have them remove the word from all teaching materials. And by the way, this lawmaker is the chair of their education committee. So some people think that this is a reaction to the state of Arizona repealing something called the No Promo Homo Law from last year. No Promo Homo Laws are what we call laws that say you can't teach about AIDS and HIV in schools because that might promote the homosexual lifestyle. We dealt with this here in Massachusetts in the 80s and the 90s, and so Arizona is sort of three decades behind us. But this morning, the good news is that she announced because of all the news coverage about this, that she's going to back off and amend the bill to remove that provision. But I have to mention, if I may, this lawmaker comes from a town called Snowflake. Oh, you can't make this stuff up.
There's the irony. How about you, Joe? What's yours?
I can actually top you, Arlene, on that one. A state senator in Vermont introduced a bill to actually ban cell phones from anybody under 21 years of age.
Oh, yeah, that's just not going to work.
No, well, you know, it's not going to work. The state senator even himself said, I probably won't even vote for it, which, you know, I thought we had wacky legislators in Massachusetts, but Vermont tops us on that. But I do think that some parents listening, including me, like Mike, there's a kernel of truth in what he said, and that cell phones are destroying, you know, kids, a lot of kids' lives. The social media, the pressures that kids are under, it's really changed how it's growing up and made it much harder to grow up. And I don't think banning cell phones is a good idea, but, you know, I think a lot of parents might sympathize with it.
All right, so I'll go to mine now. You might not know this about me, but I love space stuff. So astronomers at Harvard have discovered the largest continuous gas structure known in the galaxy here in the Milky Way. Apparently, it's 9,000 light years long. The discoverers have named it the Radcliffe Wave, and it matters because it turns out that it means we didn't quite understand the role of the sun in the Milky Way the way we should have. It turns out it crossed the wave millions of years ago and will again. So as Bob Oakes of Morning Edition says,
what that apparently means is that as you sit quietly on that recliner in your home, you are actually galactically surfing the Radcliffe Wave. You are so dope.
Mostly, I just wanted everyone to get to hear that from Bob Oakes. All right, Joe Battenfeld, political columnist at the Boston Herald and host of Battenfeld on Boston Herald Radio. Thanks for being here
today.
Thank you. And Arlene Isaacson, president of Isaacson Political Consulting and co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. Thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
And listeners... Yeah. Love it. Listeners, you are so dope. Thanks for calling in today. That's our show. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I am Tiziana Deering. The whole team thanks you for the week. And join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.
You are so dope.